Brought to you by the friendly First National Stores, New England's largest retailer of fine foods.
Good evening. One day when Mark Twain was riding through the South, he looked out the train window and saw a lanky colored yad chasing a turkey through the underbrush. Just as the darky was about to pounce on his Thanksgiving dinner, some trees and a board fence passed between the car window and the boy. And Mr. Clements, with a pained expression, turned to the man beside him and said, "Dear, dear, dear, now I've got to go through life without knowing whether or not that fellow caught the turkey. Someday I'm going back and find out." But like most people, he never did. How many men, especially at this time of year, when the old spring feeling gets them, will say, "You know what I'm going to do, Joe? I'm going up country and pick up an old house with a little piece of land. Raise my own
clothes and have some fun. Get a nice little fireplace and some woods back in it. Not too far from the village. Then back with the city. And set up." How many times has the dear lady in the back seat tapped you on the shoulder when you drove through some elevated town and said,
"Daddy, let's go over and call those folks we met on the West East trip. We promised to 3 years ago." And you say, "Not today, Mama. We will some other time." I used to know a man in Boston who said the same thing every spring. "Well, boys, in about a month, I'm taking the family for a little trip. Yep, we're going up to Penobscot. Boston to Bangor and back. I've been putting it off too long. I'm really going this year. I told the wife so yesterday." Then the first thing he knew, the years rolled by, and there wasn't any boat on the Penobscot. And that fellow died without ever seeing the sun go down behind the spruces on Owl's Head. It's funny how just a few words or a bar of music or the name of a person or place that you haven't thought of for a long time will bring back memories and visions of things that happened long, long ago. Last week, I received a letter from Mrs. George Gilchrist of Thomaston, Maine. She wrote to say that her family always listens to Yankee Yarns, and she enclosed a poem about the wreck of a Russian ship many years ago on the jagged ledges of Widow's Island, down near North Haven in Penobscot Bay. Widow's Island, why, I hadn't thought of that place since the fall of 1916, when the late John Cogswell of the Boston Sunday Post came to Rockland, Maine, and hired me to go with him to Widow's Island to make pictures of a naval hospital that had been built there in 1883. We took a motorboat from Tilson's Wharf and crossed Penobscot Bay. I photographed the buildings, and then leaving the post reporter to wander through the empty corridors of the old hospital, I walked along the shore, looking for shells, arrowheads, pieces of eight, or pirate treasure. Islands have always held a fascination for me, and this was just the place where Captain Kidd or any pirate should have buried his treasure. It is, in fact, quite near that romantic island that Elizabeth Ogilvie has written about in her new book, High Tide at Noon, one of the best books about island people I have ever read. A few berries were turning from red, and the bayberry was everywhere. On the scraggy pines above the overhanging lake, long mists were grave in the warm breeze. The sun was hot. And aside from the gulls, there wasn't a sound save the rippling of the waves as they rolled in on the beach. I followed a path along the edge of the rocks and looked down onto an old wreck. Nothing but the ribs of some long-forgotten ship that had piled up on the outer ledges in a winter storm. The heavy surf had swept the timbers up on the beach, and there, like the bones of some sea monster,
bleaching in the summer sun.
If I could get down there at low tide and prowl around, I might find something in that old hulk. Maybe a coin or two. And it would be thrilling
to learn what ship it was
and when it was wrecked. But hearing a shot from Cogswell, I returned to the motorboat for the trip back to Rockland. The smell of the fish barrels and the motion of the boat banished for the time all thought of that wreck on Widow's Island. Someday soon, I vowed, I'd go back and examine those timbers. That was 1916. The next summer, the football was on. Then I enlisted in the Navy. The old wreck was forgotten until just a few days ago when Mrs. Gilchrist left me with a poem about a shipwreck on Widow's Island early in the 19th century. The poem is called The Rescue, and it was published in a book of verses in 1882. The author's name is not given. The poem begins like this.
"Nowhere fiercer strikes the tempest than upon the coast of Maine, when the bitter cold of winter turns to ice the falling rain. Heaven help the luckless vessel
which the winds have blown this way,
in among the rugged islands of our own Penobscot Bay." Then we learn from the yellow pages of that old book that on a wild wintry night, one Captain Salathiel Robinson, listening to the roar of the surf as it crashed and boomed against the rocky hills behind his cozy cottage, heard another more ominous sound above the howl of the gale and the pounding of the sea. a sound that old salt knew at once. It was a ship's strong timbers being smashed on the ledges of Fox Island Thoroughfare. Quickly, Captain Robinson got into his oilskins.
And with lighted lantern and hip boots, he waded out into the shrieking gale, where the air was filled with salty spume and sand and the cries of men on the ship. He rounded up his crew of fishermen, young and old together, and they made their way to the wharf over which the gale-lashed tide was breaking. They could barely see the topmast of the big vessel, caught far and square in the jaws of the ledge, only a few yards offshore. There was no hope of immediate rescue in that wildly churning water. So the men went about getting ropes and lumber and blankets, and the women folks hurriedly dressed and fierced up their fires, broke out the brandy, and made pots of steaming tea, for daylight was near at hand. And when the first faint flush of pale gray light showed behind the tall black spruces on the island, that was a most unwelcome sight. For offshore a little distance, they discerned a helpless wreck at the mercy of the breakers that swept clean across her deck, with her crew up in the rigging, in the driving wind so bleak, and a tattered Russian ensign flapping wildly from her peak. One of the old-timers says, "Huh, Russians, are we going to risk
our lives for a lot of foreigners?" All eyes were on Sallybo Robinson, their captain,
waving his lantern to let the freezing men in the rigging know that help was coming. And with all the contempt that he could muster, he shouted above the roar of the breaking surf, "We'll forget that they are Russians, and remember they are men." But not a man moved. Robinson wiped the sleep from his face, and shaking with anger, he shouted, "If only Skipper Lewis were here! He and I would show you whether there's anything to fear. We used to do together, we at least would do again, if it were but to shame you, you who should be stronger men." And turning from the silent fisherman, he stomped off, up the hill, in the faint, cold light of dawn, walking as fast as over the frozen, slippery ground in his heavy boots. It was full 2 miles to the house of Skipper Lewis. And when he got there, the door was open, and there stood the old man, like a warrior clad for the fray, needing to ask what brought him at such an hour of such a day. And as they hurried back to the shore, Captain Robinson told the old skipper that his men were afraid to man the boats in such a sea. The old poem goes on. If you had seen the skipper of a Sunday in his pew, you'd have mocked him for his meekness. But all the island people knew there was force beneath his fire. And though now long past his prime, there was no more daring boatman than he'd been. At the beach, at length arriving, he suppressed his angry frown, saying, "Let's get the longboat ready. I think the wind is going down." The unsuspecting men brought the boat and shoved it into the water. Skipper Lewis raised his gold-headed cane and said, "All aboard. The man who flinches goes back home with a broken head." Not one of them, but would rather face the wrath of the sea and sky than the anger of Skipper Lewis. So grumbling under their frosty mustachios, they climbed in and grabbed the oars. The old man stood in the prow, and when the frail craft slid down the long green swells to crash head-on into a wall of water, he clung on like a demon and rose dripping and coughing to urge them on toward the sinking ship. It was his old wrinkled hand that first touched the rail of the Russian boat. The half-frozen survivors were lowered from the rigging one by one, and all were taken to shore in safety. Well, folks, that's the end of that poem. But what I want to know is, whatever became of those Russian sailors? Could that be the ship whose timbers I saw back in 1916 on the beach of Widow's Island? And what was the name of that vessel? I started out one rainy day last week to check up on that story. I went to the Boston Public Library and rummaged all through the early histories of Rockland, Vinyl Haven, North Haven, and the Fox Islands. No luck. I went down to Williams' bookstore and pored over stacks of dusty volumes on the Maine coast and shipwrecks. No luck. Even the Boston Herald Reference Library couldn't find anything. I telephoned Freddie Green of the Watertown Sun. He knows a lot about the Maine coast and such things, but he'd never heard about it. I wrote the select men of North Haven, but I haven't heard from them. Then I telephoned Governor Saltonstall's office. You know, he has a summer place on North Haven. And from him I learned that the old hospital buildings were torn down 15 years ago and that Widow's Island is now a bird sanctuary. But not a word about the Russian ship or whatever became of her crew. Last Friday evening, after the broadcast about Donald Bain, I went down to Winthrop and consulted Edward Rowe Snow, the well-known authority on New England storms and shipwrecks. But even he hadn't heard of it. We burned the midnight oil, going through old books and records, but this saga of the sea was not to be found. So, you see, if I had returned to Widow's Island, When there was plenty of time, I might have learned the truth about that Russian ship. But now, like Mark Twain, I'll have to go through life always wondering what happened. And now, here's Steve Burke with a message from my sponsor.
This is Westinghouse.
This old-time radio program was originally aired live.
Long before the advent of high fidelity.
As a result, you may detect an occasional surface noise, or volume drop.
Due to transmission problems so common to old radio.
We hope, however, that any variance in audio quality will not take away from your pleasure in listening to this.
The world is listening to OTR now.
Here, transcribed, is Richard Diamond, Private Detective, starring Dick Powell.
It was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It was cold out, and it had been raining. When it got a little warmer, it would probably snow. The whole city was covered with a heavy sheet of ice, and the steam heat in my office gurgled and clouded up the windows. I was feeling pretty good. I was warm. I'd had one client in the past week, and my bank account was on its way to recovery, and a good breakfast in the drugstore downstairs had made me comfortable and drowsy. I put my feet up on the desk, leaned back in my chair, and closed my eyes.
Mr. Diamond?
I must have been napping and didn't know it. I hadn't heard the door open, but there he stood, framed in the door, resting his weight on the jamb, and looking across the room at me with tired eyes.
Mr. Diamond?
What can I do for you?
My name is Abel Gunther. I want to hire you.
All right, Mr. Gunther. I charge you $100 a day in expenses.
I don't think I can pay it. I can pay you some, but I don't think I can pay you that much.
Well, that's my fee for you or a Rockefeller. I got expenses.
I see. Well, I'll keep looking. I need help. Perhaps you could recommend someone?
You'll pardon me for saying so, but you don't look too well, Mr. Gunther.
I'm pretty sick, Mr. Diamond.
Maybe you'd better sit down and tell me what your problem is.
I can't afford the money.
That's all right. Tell me about it anyway.
I think I had better sit down.
Yes, you better. What's wrong? You got the flu or something?
No. I'm afraid it's a little more serious. Would you really like to hear my story?
I think I really would.
I'm a farmer, Mr. Diamond. My home is Haiti, near Saint-Nazaire.
Haiti?
Yes. The West Indies. I was born there, raised there. My parents died when I was 13. I have a wife. She's there now, and she's the main reason I have come here seeking help. My wife is dying, Mr. Diamond. I must get help quickly before it is too late. I have a...
He kept talking, telling me about his life on Haiti. He told me about his farm, a fairly good-sized farm by his description. He told me how in the past 2 years things began to go wrong on his farm. And soon all the farms in the area were also having trouble.
The cane fields would burn every year. Then it was the cattle. One by one, they became sick. Then my wife, and now me.
And you don't know what's wrong with either of you, huh?
Yes and no. My Christian religion fights it, but my life on Haiti has taught me deep respect for it.
Respect for what?
Voodoo, Mr. Diamond. Oh, I know just what you're thinking. But a doctor in Haiti has examined my wife and can find nothing wrong.
Well, I don't particularly believe in anything like that, Mr. Gunther. But if you do, why have you come to me?
I said I had a healthy respect for it. I don't entirely believe it, but some of the things I've seen make it difficult to disbelieve. I came to you because I suspect a possibility of something more. Immediately after my wife was taken ill, I received an offer for my farm, a very low offer from a Saint-Léger banker. I investigated, found it had been made in the interest of one Arthur Cotswold.
Arthur Cotswold.
Haiti's biggest planter.
Oh. How about the other farmers?
They received offers like mine. Being the oldest farmer, the rest looked to me for guidance. I told them to wait. Then I came here to hire someone to look into the matter.
Would you like some water?
No. No, thank you. I'm all right.
Oh. Anyone else become ill besides you and your wife?
Yes. Several others. I have $368 in my ticket home. The money is yours if you will go to Haiti and investigate.
Have you been to a doctor here in New York?
No. Mr. Diamond, here's directions how to get to my farm. My servant, little Sheila, is there. No one knows I came.
Mr. Gunther. Mr. Gunther.
Levinson Homicide.
Hello, Walt.
Oh, Rick.
Yeah. Better get up to my office. I've got a dead man for you.
Are you kidding?
That's what Gunther told me.
Voodoo?
Voodoo, smoodoo. That's what the man said.
Now, steady, boy.
Oh, stop it, Walt. You know I don't believe it.
But you're going down to Haiti.
Well, somebody's got to tell the wife.
The local authorities can do that. Hey.
No, what's the matter?
The local authorities in Haiti. Why didn't Gunther go to them if he thought there was something phony about the setup?
You want an opinion?
If you can strain one out.
Well, Gunther probably didn't go to the Haiti authorities because he knew they'd think just what you're thinking.
Okay, so I'm crazy.
Well, Gunther died in my office. He came a long way for help, and the poor guy wanted to give me his last $368. So I'm going to Haiti. I'll send you a zombie. Walt promised to send a wire in care of the authorities in Saint-Léger as soon as he got an autopsy report on Mr. Gunther, and I headed to the airline's ticket office. By 8 o'clock that evening, I was in an airline's flagship at 12,000 feet heading for the West Indies and Haiti. The trip wasn't bad. We landed in Miami, where I grabbed a cup of coffee and then climbed aboard a clipper for Port-au-Prince. At Port-au-Prince, I took a bus to Saint-Léger, and from there a beaten-up taxi to the Gunther farm about 10 miles into the country. As we neared the farm, I could see a crowd of people standing around in front of the house. And as I climbed out of the cab and approached them, they turned and their hushed conversations were suddenly stilled. I didn't know what it was. No one said a word. But something was wrong. I could feel it. I walked through the crowd of the house and stopped cold as the door opened.
Who are you?
I'd never seen anything like him. He was a native and he ducked his head as he stepped out of the door to face me. He was a good 7 feet tall, or maybe more. He must have weighed close to 300. He stood on his bare feet, his long, muscled arms hanging loosely at his sides, and looked at me with dark, shining eyes.
Me, little Chiba, who are you?
Oh, me, very little Richard Diamond. Mr. Gunther hired me to come here.
You from New York?
Oh, yes. Mr. Gunther couldn't come back.
He died.
That's right. How did you know?
You come in?
Sure. What are all those people doing out there?
Their friend's madam. She died too.
Little Sheba led the way into the bedroom where Mrs. Gunther lay on the bed, covered with a fresh white sheet. Her eyes closed in death, her face drawn and tired. Little Sheba told me she had died the day before, about 3 p.m. And a cold chill ran up my back. I remembered her husband lying on the floor of my office about 3 p.m. the day before.
What do you do here?
Mr. Gunther wanted me to find out why the cattle are getting sick, why the fields are burning, why he and his wife became ill.
Bad voodoo.
Well, he thought it might have something to do with a man named Cotswold.
He big man.
What are those drums?
For madam and mister. They voodoo. Good voodoo. Give blessing for spirit. For madam and mister.
Oh. You see, little Sheba, the mister, Mr. Gunther wanted me to help him. He paid me money to help him and died asking for help. I'm going to try and do what I can.
The madam and mister good people. Teach little Sheba. They take little Sheba when he's small boy and make good life. You good man, little Sheba help you.
Right then, I inherited little Sheba. And if there was going to be any trouble, the giant servant would certainly help to make up the difference. The first thing I wanted to do was contact the local authorities in Saint-Léger. The Little Siva told me my man was one Inspector LaPlanche.
A very fine person, Mr. Gunther. I'm sorry he's dead.
Well, how'd everybody know he was dead?
On Haiti, things of such nature are never a secret. The natives know.
Voodoo?
Being a stranger to Haiti, Mr. Diamond, I expect you to be a skeptic.
But you believe in voodoo?
Let us say I have been in Haiti too long not to believe.
Gunther thought the whole thing might have something to do with a man named Cotswold.
I would suggest you forget Mr. Cotswold.
Then I suggest you give me a good reason to forget him.
Mr. Cotswold is a very big man on Haiti, the largest plantation owner on the West Indies, and a self-made man with a considerable temper.
Well, thanks for the advice, Inspector. But supposing I come up with something incriminating?
If Mr. Cotswold has breached the law, it would certainly be my duty to arrest him. But I am not considering the arrest. More, the necessary steps that would have to be taken to prove the guilt. Dangerous steps, Mr. Diamond. One might trip on those steps.
And break his neck.
Yes.
You like the middle of the road, huh?
It is much easier to see what is ahead.
It's possible to get run down from behind.
I do as much as I can to prevent that possibility. Example, my suggestion, you forget Mr. Cotswold.
I left the philosophical inspector and went outside where little Chiva had been waiting. Every time I looked at Chiva, it was like a little kid spotting the Empire State for the first time. He smiled a mouthful of white teeth as he said,
"The inspector. He say forget Mr. Cotswold."
That's right. What do you think, little Chiva?
I think I do what you want.
You know what I want?
You want go see Cotswold.
Think I'm crazy?
You're not afraid. You're not strong like little Chiva. But little Chiva think of all the men he know, you would fight hardest.
I don't like to fight, little Chiva.
Little Chiva know that. We go see Cotswold.
Little Chiva led the way up a long, narrow road surrounded on both sides by high sugarcane fields. Somewhere from not too far away, I heard the drums start again. Little Chiva stopped, looked off to the north. He began moving his shoulders, slowly keeping time to the steady rhythm of the drums. He began to sing softly.
Oh, hey, oh, hey. Say, Papa Nuki, Papa, say, oh, hey, oh, hey. Say, Papa Nuki, Papa, say.
What does that mean, little Shiva?
It means in your language, it is our Papa who passes.
Papa?
Papa Dambala, the great source.
Voodoo?
Yes. Later, I must leave you. Today is Wednesday. This is the day of Papa Dambala. Oh, hey, oh, hey, say, Papa Nuki, Papa.
He continued his little chant until we reached the beginning of a long, high fence running along next to the narrow road. Chiva leaned down and swung a gate open. Then we walked up the path that led through the Cotswold property until we reached the house. There, sitting back between two huge trees, was the Cotswold mansion. I walked up to the front door alone.
Mr. Diamond.
Yes, Siva?
Watch out for Mr. Jocelyn. He guards Cotswold.
Thanks, I'll do that.
What do you want?
I want to see Cotswold.
You do, eh? What are you doing here, little Siva?
I wait for Mister.
He found himself a new governor, what? You must be that fellow Diamond.
I must be.
Well, come in. Mr. Cotswold has been expecting you.
He introduced himself as Jocelyn and led the way into a large panel study. And I met the big man himself, Arthur Cotswold. The drums stopped.
Today is Wednesday. It belongs to the great god Dambala.
So I understand.
Most days of the week are significant in voodoo. Will you have a drink, Mr. Diamond?
No, thank you.
Jocelyn, mix me his gin and tonic.
Yes, Mr. Cotswold.
Thursday and Saturday belong to Uzile Frida, the goddess of love.
I'll have to remember that.
I know why you are here, Mr. Diamond.
I'm glad you do.
For some reason, Gunther and the rest of the miserable farmers think I'm responsible for their trouble.
Of course you're not.
I simply tried to help them. With their cattle sick and their crops gone, I had my banker make them an offer.
Have any of your cattle taken sick?
None.
Pretty strange. Haiti is a strange land. Now, you're not going to start talking voodoo. You're a stranger, Mr. Diamond. There are many things that you would not understand, and I would certainly not try and convert you.
Well, I appreciate your interest, but I intend to find out why Gunther and his wife died.
At this point, I would most certainly give you advice on. Go home, Mr. Diamond. Leave well enough alone.
After I come up with an answer.
Mr. Diamond, I am not a patient man. I have gone out of my way to give you some healthy advice. Heed it. For your sake, heed it.
No thanks. I'll let you know what I find out.
You persist in this investigation?
I always persist. In fact, I'm the persistentist. I left Arthur Cotswold cooling his fit with a gin and tonic, went back to Cheever, and he led me back to town. On the way, I got an idea. When we arrived in town, I sent Little Cheever back to the Gunther farm. Then I went in to talk to Inspector LaPlanche. The inspector had received a wire from one Lieutenant Walt Levinson, 5th Precinct, New York Police.
Well, I had no idea the New York police were interested in this affair.
They're always interested when someone drops dead. Now, here's something pretty interesting, Inspector. Mr. Gunther died of a disease known as brucellosis, commonly known in cattle as Bang's disease. Ever heard of it?
I am not a medical man, Mr. Diamond.
Well, it's undulant fever. Both Gunther and his wife probably caught it from their sick cattle.
What do you intend to do?
I think those cattle were infected deliberately, and the cane fields burned purposely. If the cattle were infected deliberately, there must be some of the brucellosis still around, and I'm going to find it. Maybe at Mr. Cotswold's. I think you better issue a search warrant. Come with me.
Mr. Diamond, the middle of the road, remember?
I think you'd better forget the middle of the road, Inspector. Unless you want me to get in touch with the authorities and have you held as a material witness in a murder case.
I will issue the warrant.
I kind of thought you would.
I will issue it, but you certainly do not think it will be enough to get you into the Cotswold house?
No, but it'll make it legal. I sent Little Cheever back to collect some of his friends. They're going to help us get in that house, Inspector.
I will have no part of violence.
Oh, they won't even be with us. It would be easy to search the Cotswold place if Cotswold was out fighting fire.
Fire?
Just a harmless fire, Inspector. But far enough away so that Cotswold will think it's his cane fields.
Oh, well, then I will certainly issue the warrant, Mr. Diamond. As long as we are going to do everything open and above board, I will certainly issue it.
Welcome back to the gutter, Inspector. The view isn't much, but you can't miss where you're going. Let's go get Little Cheever.
Those natives doing at the Gunthers.
I don't know.
It looks like something's wrong.
We piled out of the car and pushed our way through the crowd of natives. Inside the house, we found what was wrong. Lying in the middle of the room was Little Cheever. He was almost dead when I knelt beside him.
I talked to friends. They light fire for you.
Thanks, Cheever.
Now, Dumbalo Red or take me.
He's been stabbed.
And they cut him in two. They got him from behind. Never would have faced him.
You stay. You see, waitele non tete your mort.
See what? It is a ritual. It means taking the spirit from the head of the dead. He wants you to see it.
You stay. You believe voodoo.
All right, Cheever. I'll stay. Now, who did this to you?
Nazi. And back.
He's dead. The next few hours I'll never forget. The inspector knew what was coming and he wanted no part of it, so he waited outside. I don't know whether I can describe it, but I'll try. And even though I saw it with my own eyes, I still don't quite believe it. The natives came into the house and picked up Little Cheever. They placed him on a bench and the ceremony began. Some of them had already obtained the necessary items used for Waiti Loa non tete yom mort. They included several live pigeons, olive oil, 30 pieces of fat pine wood, a pair of chickens, some coarse cornmeal, and a saddle blanket, and a large white plate. Little Chiva's body was covered with a blanket, and then the pigeons were killed and cooked without seasoning. The cornmeal was roasted and then placed in a white plate. The 30 slivers of pine wood were lighted and carried by the natives like candles. Then one of the natives took the white plate with the meal in one hand and the pot with the chicken in the other and approached the fire, chanting a strange dirge. I nearly ran out of the screaming memes. As he finished the last line of the chant, the dead body of Little Chiva sat straight up with straining eyes, bowed its head, and fell back.
You look a little pale, Mr. Diamond.
Well, I can't understand why. Probably because my blood's hiding in my feet.
What do you think of voodoo now?
Well, let's forget it, shall we? I haven't got the money for a good rest home.
Yeah. We're close to the Cotswolds.
Good. Let's park it here and wait until the fire starts. The inspector and I sat in the car and waited while the moon climbed up over the clouds and the drums in the distance tangled my nerves into complete knots. After about an hour of waiting, a dull glow to the south started the expected commotion in the Cotswold household, and we climbed out of the car.
Fire, Mr. Cotswold! The Greenfield! Fire! Hit the servants! Get every man out there to fight that fire!
It had worked. The inspector and I stayed to the shadows until the last man went running out of the house. Then we went in. We worked as fast as we could. We took the place apart. And I must say, the timid inspector had really gotten out of the middle of the road. He tore the place apart like he'd spent most of his time on a wrecking crew.
I have not found a thing.
Oh, the house is clean.
There's a barn.
Then let's go. We went out of the house and headed for the barn about 50 yards away. The drums were louder now, and the dull glow of the fire had nearly vanished. It was obvious that the inspector and I had to work fast. He took one end of the barn and I took the other. We worked toward each other. Just about the time I was ready to give the whole thing up.
Diamond! Diamond!
Inspector, you find something?
This hypodermic for cattle.
That's not enough.
This butter hidden under this box?
Well, it's more like it. Let's get it back to town and have it analyzed.
That won't be necessary, Mr. Diamond.
Cotswold.
It was Cotswold. And he had three things on his side that made the situation very uncomfortable. His bodyguard, Jocelyn, and two guns. They stepped through the open door and moved up to us.
I see you found my secret, Mr. Diamond.
This is the stuff you've been infecting the cattle with. And this is what killed the Gunters.
That's correct. You see, you should have really taken my advice and returned to the States.
You'll be held for murder, Cotswold.
Who will convict me, Mr. Diamond? No evidence, no one to testify. I'm surprised at you, Inspector. I thought you had more sense.
Sometimes a man finds his pride and does the best thing.
You know, of course, I can't allow either of you to live.
No, we had a hunch. Now, tell me something. Who killed Little Chiva?
He was getting to be a nuisance. I had Jocelyn here attend to the matter.
What's that?
Diamond.
Mr. Cotswold, look!
Well, now, I want to tell you, I'd seen a lot that day, but that was just a little too much. The howl had come from the open door, and standing in it, framed against the yellow moon...
It's him! It's Little Chiva!
No! No!
But there he was. And he looked even bigger as he shuffled toward the two men, his arms swinging at his sides like two giant sledgehammers. He was going all the way. He hadn't just come back from the dead to sit up. He was taking a walk.
Get away! Get away! You're dead!
Shoot him! Shoot him!
But Jocelyn was too terrified to even raise his arm. The big native reached out, grabbed him with both hands, and crushed him like an egg. For a minute, I was too stunned to move. Then when I saw Cotswold bring up his gun, I threw the bottle. It stopped him long enough for the big native to drop Jocelyn's limp body and charge in. Like an idiot, I had some stupid reason for wanting Cotswold alive, so I tried to head Chiva off. Ever try to stop a freight train with both hands out? He brushed me off, and I crashed into the wall just as he grabbed Cotswold.
No! No!
He picked him up, raised him high over his head, and threw him the length of the barn.
Diamond. He's coming over here.
Now, look, old boy. It's me, Diamond.
Little Chiva, please, I...
Me not, Little Chiva.
What?
I should have guessed.
Should have guessed what? What is this?
This is Big Chiva.
Big Chiva?
Oui, me Little Chiva's brother. Me pay back for kill Little Chiva.
Oh, good gosh.
I never thought that.
Oui, me Big Chiva. Come, I take you back to Gunther House. Little Chiva say you good man. I be your servant.
Well, if you don't mind, I just think I'll head back for the States and lie in a warm tub of mud for the next 6 months. Tell me something, Big Chiva.
What do you want?
You don't have a big brother, do you?
Listen next week for another exciting transcribed adventure of Richard Diamond, starring Dick Powell. This is the American Broadcasting Company.
Whitehall 1212.